We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, for the past 3 years, the cable network AMC has been giving viewers a chance to step back into the America of the 1960s with its hit series Mad Men. It's set in a fictional advertising agency in New York. It's gotten very high marks from critics. It's won a lot of awards. In fact, it was the first basic cable series ever to win an Emmy for a dramatic series. A lot of people enjoy the program. It's a guilty pleasure for them, but there also are some folks who say that it does offer an opportunity to maybe reflect a little bit on just how much has changed in the way that we think about some important issues, things like gender and race. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will try to do a little bit of just that with three guests, all of them here from the University of Illinois, and all people who will be participating in a symposium that will take place on the campus at the end of the week on Friday. It's a symposium organized by the Unit for Criticism and Interpretive Theory here at the University of Illinois. And the title they put on it is Mad World, Sex, Politics, Style, and the 1960s. And then we'll be looking at various aspects of not just the series itself, but also the world as it was at the time. And we have three guests here with us in the studio to talk. Clarence Lang is Assistant Professor of African American Studies in the Department of History. Here at the University of – or a professor of African American Studies, and he is also in the Department of History here at the U of I. Lilia Kaganovsky is Associate Professor of Slavic Languages and Literature, and Leslie Regan is Associate Professor of History, Medicine, Gender, and Women's Studies and Law here at the University of Illinois. So we're pleased they could be with us here in the studio to have some conversation. People who are listening can call in and share their thoughts and questions. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And you may email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
We certainly appreciate it. And I know that the program has been very popular and people enjoy watching it. And at the same time, I would imagine that a lot of people would come to the show and would look at it. They would look at the way that it deals with things like race and class and gender. They would look at these characters and see the values that they seem to exhibit and say, well, these people, they're sexist, they're racist, they're homophobic, they're anti-Semitic. About the only green thing they're interested in is money. That and, as my guy on the board, Jason Croft, said, yeah, that and the olive in their martini. So I could find two green things that they're really interested in. And so it's a very colorful show. It looks great. It has colorful characters. But there's all this other stuff going on, and so that really makes you wonder, well, what exactly is the appeal of this program? I'll give you each chance maybe to talk a little bit about just that basic question. What is the appeal of this program, do you think? Yeah, look, Professor Regan, you can start.
That was what we didn't answer. Who goes first? Well, I first heard about the show really from the New York Times, where they were covering the design elements, the modern, the 1950s furniture, and really their incredibly close attention to the furniture and the clothing. And that sparked my attention, actually. Hmm. And I actually watched it the first time interested in that. And it's a very rich show if you're just interested in design and color. I actually couldn't stand what I saw the first time I watched it. And my feeling was, I really don't need to watch an hour more of sexism every time I watch this, and I turned it off and left. So I've returned to the show. A friend suggested that I might find it much more interesting. So I'll leave it at that. And really, well, it is a really interesting question. I would like to have focus groups to tell me who is watching the show and what's bringing them to the show. I mean, I know sort of anecdotally from people, and I've just gotten caught up in the complexity of the stories and their efforts to produce an incredibly accurate show. Yeah. Well, I'll let our other people go on.
I'll go around the table and order people are seated. So we'll go next to Professor Kaganovsky.
Sure. Well, I
I love the show, but I loved it from the beginning. In fact, I think I loved it from the moment I read a New York Times article describing the show before it was even aired, and already fell in love because of the fetish detail and mm-hmm. and things like that. But I actually think that the show is incredibly clever in the way that it's constructed. And that what it manages to balance is a kind of a nostalgia on the one hand, and on the other hand, I mean, you said guilty pleasure, and it's an interesting phrase because it makes it sound like, you know, there's something wrong with the show. Actually, there's something right about the show. Which is to say that what it manages to do is a kind of double look on the 60s. On the one hand, it gives us a nostalgic picture for a life that's clearly gone, that's clearly passed away. We no longer have it. We, for some reason, the years separating us from 1960 and 1962 have had enormous, enormous changes. And we no longer see that world as in any way related to us. At the same time, I think there's a way in which it starts to make us recognize the kinds of things that we now take for granted, that we where we think that we are, ecologically conscious and no longer misogynist and no longer sexist and racist and anti-Semitic, all of these things. You know, we think that we are above this, but in fact, I think the show makes us recognize that we're not as far away from all of this as we thought that we were.
Yeah. All right. Well, Professor Lang?
I can't add too much more to that, but this idea of nostalgia, I think, is really important, but I think that in some ways, I think there's a generational piece in terms of who develops in green light. So I think that there's still, I'll use this word, navel gazing for those people who came of age in the 1960s. And I think that's still pretty much the case. And we've seen that since the 1980s. But I think this point about these ideas of identity, representation, which are, which is, has been said, are still very salient today. So in some ways, we get a glimpse at the beginnings of the culture wars, these ideas of identity, at that moment just before many of those social struggles heated up. And we're in a position where we can see what's coming around the corner in the way that the characters can't. And that makes it a very interesting kind of a dynamic. So you know when November 1963 comes, well, there's a very big event that's occurring. You know that when you see, we were talking about this in the lobby, men chasing women around the office and tackling them because they want to know what color their undergarments are in the office. You know that there's a struggle coming against that. When you see the black man on the elevator or who's selling the sandwiches, or the black woman who's attending to the Draper family's children, or the black women who are the washroom attendants, you know that there's a struggle that's coming, and in fact is actually occurring at that moment. But in many people's, it's still on the margins, but is very much approaching. Yeah.
And just to make sure I get people who have not seen the show are clear that the time period we're talking about, it when it begins, it's 1960. At the point where they are now, it's end of 1963. So already people who were watching it have seen both the election and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. They've seen the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. All the stuff that was going on there, mm-hmm. they have seen, or at least that's been peripheral to the action. And I think, as you say, what one of the things people find really interesting is that they recognize that here's a point where we're just on the brink of tremendous social, cultural, political change, and that it's looking on this in a way is like looking at life on another planet somehow, and it seems that different. But I do take the point that Professor Kaganowski made about how we still all those things that you can find to be really unhappy about it here, you can still find them in American life and in American society.
I think that they're not as obviously on display anymore, perhaps, or not as obviously in these ways, in the ways that the show displays them, but they're still there. One of the things, you know, that the elevator operator, I just recently rewatched the episode where Pete Campbell is talking to the black elevator operator, and he says, and he's grilling him about Admiral televisions and what kind of television he has. And the operator says at one point, he says, look, every job has its ups and downs. And it seems like one of these incredibly, you know, silly throwaway lines, this idea of an elevator operator who obviously spends his entire life, you know, with the job going up and down, right? On the other hand, it is a line taken straight from melodrama, from a Douglas Sirk type of melodrama, Imitation of Life, the woman who goes down the staircase as she's descending the staircase, says, I'm going up and up and up. It's all about class movement. It's all about, you know, the possibilities and impossibilities of transcending certain kinds of boundaries. And here you have an elevator operator who's stuck in the same position going up and down. He's not moving up or down in class, or maybe he is. Maybe that is what's around the corner, or maybe it isn't. And I think that the show, when you start to look at it closely, right, when you sort of, you know, the show is so much about surface. It's right. So much about the beauty of its production. Mm-hmm. But when you start to look at it closely, there's actually also a lot there to be understood and picked
mm-hmm. at. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about one kind of criticism that I've read of the series is that some people say, in fact, that it makes this period, it makes the 60s look worse than they actually were. It's not to say that all this stuff that we're talking about, racism and sexism and all this kind of stuff, it's not that it wasn't there. But some people have said, you know, it wasn't quite that bad. It's been magnified. And what it does, it allows us to take this very self-congratulatory posture and say, well, aren't we so much more enlightened than those people were then?
That's a very interesting criticism. That really is, I think, the nostalgia that wants Leave It to Beaver to be presented as reality. I mean, I think Mad Men and oddly is fairly accurate in some of this. I do think Mad Men. I mean, we haven't said, if you haven't watched the show, that it is about an advertising agency in New York City, and it focuses on the advertising men primarily, and also their families. And it really, as you watch it, you realize it's all work family. Yeah. And the show is at least half or more about sex. So there's probably more sex in the show because it's playing to the 21st century. But in terms of the language and the treatment of people, in terms of sex, the new words we now have, like sexism and homophobia, this is not an exaggeration. Some people may not have – many people, of course, didn't notice it at the time. It was normal. They wouldn't have noticed it or remembered it. Mm-hmm. It's only something that came to be noticed and remembered and named later on. And certainly that's part of a backlash later, is we don't want to think of it that way and remember it that way, that somehow these things that some of us talk about now about inequality and the need for justice – is something that developed, in the 70s? It's unfair. It's not true, right? That we're still having these discussions. And it is true. And it was true.
I think there are two things. I mean, I think that one, a lot of the appeal of the show is about the fact that, and this has been stated, but just to put a finer point on it, is that, I mean, we're still carrying the baggage of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, many of those issues are ongoing in a very real kind of way. But I also think that one of the things that I liked about, and I was a latecomer to the show, I came in at a latter period, is the focus, the show's focus on the interior lives of folks. And so I think the show does a good job. I mean, for those people who would criticize it as being too negative, I think they do a good job, the producers, what have you, the actors. And you don't have heroes and villains. Everyone has a very complex inner life. And you go from one episode to another where you identify with this person, and then in the next episode, you know, you feel estranged from them. Mm-hmm. And my view, at least, is that I think the show has done a good job of giving us a sense of those complexities. Mm-hmm. So you have the bored housewife. All of these characters could be stereotypes, and they could play them out that way. But they really do a good job of, I mean, and the way that they leave all these questions open-ended. So you have the narrative of Don Draper, who, you know, on the surface is, you know, this well-to-do, middle-class ad executive. But he's also has some yearnings to be a bohemian in some kind of – I mean, there's this kind of identity that he's wrestling with. Yeah. We think about Betsy as his wife. I mean, you have the episode where she's dealing with the feminine mystique in being the housewife, and you have that at the end of the episode where she's shooting birds, her neighbors, you know, pigeons or what have you, and what do you do with this? You know, there's something that's going on here we don't quite know. So it's a bad paraphrase of a lyric from that time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose it's that's one of the things that series television will allow you to do. If you can spend a long time with a set of characters, you can then do a lot with developing those characters, their interior lives, what they're all about. If you can devote hours and hours and hours and hours to it, and I suppose then that way you could even get at least partly invested in a character that you don't like. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you feel about Don Draper. This is probably not your dream date.
Nope. I don't think about him in terms of dates, but I like the show. And as Clarence is saying, they're fascinating. It's really fascinating to follow these stories, and it's a very smart show, mm-hmm. in the way that they've put together storylines and parallel storylines, yeah. of different characters. And as you're watching more of it, and as you start to analyze it for a conference, you have parallel characters. And I mean, I've been looking at reproduction and sexuality in particular for my talk, and because that's what I do. Mm-hmm. And there are three or four women and couples with different storylines, with a single woman who's completely naive and innocent is the first storyline with Peggy, and then her partner we end up finding with his wife. They're dealing with infertility and possibly adoption, and then you have the main characters and most privileged of all, Betty and Dawn, where she's pregnant and doesn't want to be. So you have all of these different couples in different ways with the same experience. And they do it very well in kind of making it a complicated situation where it's not obvious what the responses are going to be.
One of the things that I read about the show that I thought was interesting, given, I guess, what we know about the entertainment business, is that at this point, as of the last season, 7 of the 9 writers of the show were women.
Uh-huh.
And
I believe that, yeah.
that 5 of the 13 episodes were directed by women. Uh-huh. Do you think that actually you can see that kind of sensibility, particularly if you look at, for example, the kind of things that you're as a scholar that you're interested in?
Yes. I mean, I think I've been thinking about that because I think, of course, men can have some of these experiences and be with women and be very sensitive to it and could be inserting stories that they know of. Right. That's possible. But there are elements of the show that, I mean, this examination that Peggy goes through, I think, is probably the best thing I've ever seen that shows a gynecological examination with a doctor, and then the comments that the doctor makes seem absolutely appropriate for this time period. And I just think, yeah, there are elements. And there, obviously, the writer is very interested in gender politics and gender dynamics and very interested in producing a history that shows things have changed and things are better. And they are also interested in not only has it changed for women and not only was it bad for women, it's changed for men and it was bad for men. Now, we might want to discuss that, whether that was an equal thing. But that is, I think, one of the primary kind of drives for the writer. If you get the DVD sets, they have these additional little mini documentaries, actually, that they've produced. And that's what they're talking about. It was also, you know, for men, this was traumatic times also. And so I think that more than anything is kind of what's driving the show. I mean, I want to talk more about that with Clarence.
Yeah. Well, you have anything to? Okay. Let me reintroduce our guests. We have three people here with us around the table. Leslie Regan, she is Associate Professor of History, Medicine, Gender, and Women's Studies and Law here at the U of I. Lilia Kaganovsky, she is Associate Professor of Slavic Languages and Literature. And Clarence Lang is Assistant Professor of African American Studies, and he's also in the Department of History here at University of Illinois. And all of them are involved in a symposium that's taking place at the end of the week on the campus, something organized by the Unit for Criticism and Interpretive Theory, and it's called Mad World, Sex, Politics, and Style and the 1960s, and it is and looking at various ways at this television series that we've been talking about, Mad Men, which airs on the AMC cable channel. It is now going – sometime this year, I guess it will be going into its 4th season. if people have not seen this and you'd like to, I think that most of this now is on DVD. So if you want to go back and get caught up on the series. And as Professor Regan explained, it is set in an advertising agency in New York City. It's called Mad Men because the agency's on Madison Avenue, and that was a term, I think, as an actual term
that they called them
Mad Men, these guys, and of course they were guys who were working in advertising at the time. And you get to see them deal with the politics of the time, with gender relations of the time. You get them deal with issues like whether or not it's good for you to smoke, all kinds of stuff like that. And people are constantly smoking through the whole thing. Everybody's smoking. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm just interested in having Clarence Lang talk a little bit more about race and about how race comes up in this, because as you've mentioned, you know, the African-American characters that you see, the people who appear, are all in service roles. They're housekeepers and they're elevator operators and they're waiters, and it's all that kind of thing. And I guess I just wonder, you know, how it is you feel about it when you watch it.
It's a challenge. I mean, if you're trying to do a project on this, because in some ways you're dealing with the absences or the fact that when they come into play, it's in very marginal kinds of ways. And so, again, if we think of Hollis, the elevator operator, we don't really get much of a sense of his interior life. I mean, he has that one really good comment. I'm glad because I remember that comment. Every job has its ups and downs. And that actually is a very suggestive comment. That says something that, you know, actually there's more going on here with this guy. He's not just pushing buttons. But you don't get as much of a sense of that character, or of Carla, again, who looks after the Draper's family, as you do other characters. And so the challenge becomes, what do you then do with that? You know, certainly we know, and we get a glimpse of that in the show, that you have a burgeoning civil rights struggle that's occurring. But the show tends to proceed from an assumption that that's centered almost exclusively in the South. If we have a better sense of the fact that there are actually struggles that are taking place in New York City and other northern cities, then that creates the basis potentially for the producers or writers to go a little bit more in depth into the lives of these marginal characters. But again, there's an assumption that this is all happening in the South. Mm-hmm. And so then I think that sort of plays into the marginality of the Black characters, even though at the same time, I actually appreciate what the creators are doing on their own terms, because in some ways they're speaking to the fact that these people are absent in these environments, or when they are present, they're kind of seen and not heard. They're really not, they're objects to try ideas out on, or they're sort of witnesses, in the case of the Draper's family, witnesses to Betty's steps toward infidelity, but they're not really agents in and of themselves. I think to the extent that we understand that there was a Black freedom struggle, that there was civil rights struggle at this time occurring in Brooklyn and Harlem, what have you, that opens the basis for more conversation. And so as someone who does African-American social movements, that's kind of the way that I come into the conversation, by asking those kinds of questions and trying to get a sense of, if we take seriously the interior life of someone like Carla, what then does that say about the kinds of struggles that off screen, in this case, are occurring at that moment? I don't know if that answers the question, but mm-hmm. you really have to come at it at a very different angle. I think that there's a way that if you're thinking about women and gender, I mean, it's very delicious stuff that you can deal with. I mean, it's really fertile ground that you can deal with there. If you're coming at it from the standpoint of African-Americans, people of color, you have to come at it at a little bit more of an angle, and more indirectly. But I think equally as fruitfully, though.
Yeah. One thing I'm just curious about, and I don't know if this is something that Professor Kaganovsky, you've thought about, but I guess I'm just thinking, based on your interest in, you know, Soviet era popular culture, this is the Cold War that we're talking about here. Is there anything there that particularly interests you that in terms of what was going on geopolitically, or is that way too sort of way too much off on the periphery to be something that you can grab hold of?
That's interesting. I, you know, as you were introducing me, you introduced me as somebody who does Slavic, but I actually also do comp lit and also do cinema studies. But I have to say, I think that I keep the two slightly separate. I've been working a fair bit recently on sort of Soviet 60s culture and the kinds of and the, you know, what that looks like visually, where it's trying, you know, to some degree trying to copy the sort of the American versions and the introduction of different kinds of music and shorter skirts and, you know, a kind of, you know, loosening in terms of in terms of the reading material and the kind of the political situation, the kind of thawing out, you know, that that happens in the 60s to the Soviets. But I can't quite, you know, this is something actually that the Professor Diane Conker is going to talk about on Friday. She's going to do a kind of, you know, Soviet 60s take on Mad Men and, you know, and have a response there. I think what's interesting to me is the relationship of, I mean, you know, in a certain sense, masculinity, right? The masculinity in the show is very much constructed for, you know, specifically for Don, it's constructed on the fact that he's not a war hero, but pretends to be one, right? Mm-hmm. And so what you have is both Cooper and Sterling are, you know, went through World War One, World War Two, went through the two big wars, and part of their identity is based on the fact that they were really in the war and for real. Don, of course, is in Korea for about 5 minutes, and his entire identity is built is fake, right? Is completely false, and so that the notion of self and other. The way that you know the way that the Soviet Union and the U.S. sort of paired off against each other, the way that they constructed the enemy as the other, actually to a certain degree, Don can't do that, right? Because his identity is based on a false premise. Does that make sense? I think
sure.
So there's a way in which all of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the things that show up in the show that have to do with this kind of fear of the enemy, have to do also with a certain kind of assuredness of a 50s lifestyle for the U.S., right? The comfort. And I think Don always represents the slippage out of that comfort zone.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a really interesting point, and I hope we have not spoiled anything for anybody because here this is an important plot point that I think actually comes out fairly early in the
first season.
Right in the beginning, where you discover that Don Draper is in fact not who he says he is. He's as you say, he's not Don Draper. And that, I suppose, you know, gives you some opportunity to talk about alienation. You know, if anything is symbolic of alienation, it's a guy who is not who he says that he is. And then I guess the question is, well, okay, who is he? Is that something you think ends up being an important theme that ends up being explored and that he ends up, in a sense, embodying?
Absolutely. there's the opening credits, which were not, you know, Matthew Weiner's, but nonetheless, you know, something that they chose for the show. Don is, or a Don-like figure is falling off of a skyscraper. There's a point at which the credit sequence changes point of view, and in fact, and we're no longer seeing the figure falling off the building. We're now falling off the building. The point of view is now ours, as if we're coming down. I think there's a strong identification for the viewer with Don. And at the same time, and this is again where I think the show is very clever, a recognition that Don is a construct, that Don is an impossibility, that Don is something that is absolutely empty on the inside, that is all about the external construction. And so we are just as much alienated, we're just as much at risk of having our identity revealed as a kind of empty construct as Don is. And so I think that that's part of the show's both appeal. We have this, you know, identification with a very, very handsome, very, very successful, very, very sort of dominant male. And at the same time, the knowledge that all of that is a show. All of that is a put on. All of that is a performance.
We have a caller to bring in the conversation. Let's do that. Someone calling on our toll-free line. They're in Spring Bay, on line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're getting to it with the talk about alienation. It seems to me that most of these characters suffer from a profound emptiness inside, and they're just sort of going through the motions, trying to find their way in life. And the ironic tag to that is that they are in the business of creating desire in the country through advertising. And they're lost themselves. To go back also to an earlier comment about the detail of the design elements, there's nothing new in that. That dates back to really the turn of the 20th century with David Belasco and naturalism. And that idea says that people's behavior are products of their heredity and environment. So the environment is the setting and the time. The heredity would be the class, their background. The Don Draper character, we don't know what his real background is, except he came out of a very impoverished, empty childhood. So I'll just add those comments, and I'll get off and listen to you the rest of the conversation.
Thank you. Thanks very much. You want to react to what the caller said? Other than I would say that there was a lot of nodding of heads around the table here when they were listening to what the caller had to say.
But I'll make this comment, because I think that there's a way in which what Don is doing can also, depending on how one wants to interpret it, play itself out as Don being the quintessentially self-made man, mm-hmm. that he creates himself. He advises his brother, his stepbrother, we'll use that term, who seeks him out, who sees him in a newspaper when he wins an award and comes to him and wants to reconnect, and he gives him $5,000 and says, you know, go create your life, in so many words. Make yourself as well. I did that. You need to do the same. This can't be. And so it seems like it goes potentially in both directions, depending on which interpretation you want to, the spin that you want to put on it. So it seems like at the same time the show, one could argue that is reinforcing these ideas of the American dream. You kind of become what you are through pluck and hard work. But at the same time, I think as Lilia is saying, it subverts that too. At the same time, so so these characters in many ways are conforming, but they're also rebelling at the same time in these very different kinds of, you know, micro rebellions maybe.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm really interested. I hadn't really thought as much about it until this point, but I guess I'm really interested in the setting in the advertising agency being so important in that, you know, what happens in advertising is people are selling a product, they're promoting a product, and they do that by creating a story around it. And that's really what these characters are doing, maybe most importantly with Don Draper, but everybody is trying to do that. They're trying to write their story. Mm-hmm. And sometimes writing a story around something that's hollow on the inside. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's certainly true for somebody like Peggy, who's very much, mm-hmm. again, you know, a kind of – because Don has the same advice for her essentially as he has for his brother, right? You know, after Peggy has the baby, he basically – you know, he says, look – start over. You will be surprised by how much this never happened, right? there's a way in which, you know, I actually thought at first, you know, watching the first season that Peggy was going to be our sort of focus and character of identification, in the sense that she enters the ad agency. In the first episode, we come in with her. She's the new girl. We're very much sort of sutured into her position initially as this person introduced to this environment. And then we watch her create this, you know, create this space for herself that is neither the ultra feminine position of someone like Joan, nor the ultra masculine one of someone like Dawn, right? And she's there trying to negotiate that strange undefined in between space.
Yeah, and is she? Now, forgive me now. She's the character that literally starts out as the secretary, but then manages
right. mm-hmm.
to
yeah.
becomes a copywriter.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it one very rare example in this series of a woman who is in some other position other than wife, mm-hmm. girlfriend, or secretary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
One thing I'm interested in having you talk about it, and you know, this is no great insight on my part, that when you look at historical fiction, it is always as much about the time in which it is being produced as it is the time in which it is set. So that this, even though we're talking about the 1960s, there have to be many ways in which this series is really about now. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. I mean, how is this really about now, about 2010, as much as it is about 1960?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think just,
exactly.
Yeah, one way to read it, I think, is that, I mean, we go back to this issue of nostalgia, that I think what we see, and I'm going out on a limb here, because I think one of the things that we see in the series is that we see a time when people were, however loosely, covered by a social contract. Mm-hmm. So there is this idea of the stable employment. And depending on who you were, racially, gender, what have you, you know, home ownership, this idea of stability, there's this kind of golden age. And you know, one has to be careful because I'm, you know, taking liberties. But I mean, I think we're in a time period when those kinds of things are, I mean, they were never complete anyway. I mean, that social safety net was never a net that captured everyone. But we certainly are in a situation, I think, where the idea of a social safety net has become kind of a quaint idea. And in some ways, I don't know, maybe people are hearkening back to this period where things were rougher, people were cruder, crueler, but there was more predictability, that there were clearly assigned roles that people played. And even though people found ways to try and slip out of it, those things were worked out, as opposed to our moment where, you know, our basic ideas of civil society, the social fabric are up in the air, whether you're talking about a public university or any other environment. But that's just me going out on a limb.
Yeah.
No, I think that that's right, because one of the scenes that I always think about is this. And I'll preface this by saying that there's a great quote on Wikipedia about Mad Men that says, "Mad Men depicts parts of American society and culture of the 1960s, highlighting cigarette smoking, drinking, sexism, adultery, homophobia, anti-Semitism, racism, and a complete lack of concern for the environment." It's, I think, slightly without humor, but maybe not. There's a scene where Betty and Don and the children are out on a picnic, and as they're leaving, Betty takes the picnic blanket and she just kind of dumps all of the garbage on the grass, and then they get into the Cadillac and they drive off. And it's one of those scenes that's precisely calculated on the one hand to make the viewer think, "Oh, we are so much better now." And yet, as I keep saying, I think that there's a kind of double work that's being done for this show. I wonder if it's in some part this is also obviously a comment on class and class privilege. It is also perhaps a comment on the idea that public spaces and the fact that public spaces would be taken care of, the fact that there may be somebody who will come and then clean up this garbage the way that we no longer have that expectation. I don't know. There's something else at stake, I think, maybe in that moment where it's showing us not simply their carelessness and we know so much better now, but also perhaps where they thought that they were and how the world was constructed, that there is a kind of social contract about what can and cannot be done and who it's done by.
And to whom.
Yeah. And to whom. Mm. And I think that nostalgia perhaps is because we are so confused right now. I don't – maybe that's one of the attractions of the show, or maybe that's one of the stakes of the show is a kind of our own confusion about where we – where we are and what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Well, I mean, it is an interesting question. I guess it goes back to I want focus groups that tell me who's watching the show and what their reactions are. So
30 million viewers.
So we can go back to, you know,
upscale
no.
adults, 25 to 54.
Oh, okay, you know. Upscale. See, that's what I wanted to know. And do we know about race and age?
Not yet.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I do think one thing that pulls people in would be the fantasy of, right, you can drink all the time and smoke all the time anywhere and everywhere, and sex seems to be everywhere and anywhere as well.
Protected? I wonder. So, is it protected?
Well, no.
Everybody gets pregnant.
And the consequences are fairly minimal.
Right,
I mean, they come up, but not very often.
I'm sorry, Lisa.
No, exactly. And the word clap does come up once, but it's a way of getting back at another man. I guess, just to add on really to what you've already said is that you could also see it if change is coming, right? That things are going to get better in the future, as Clarence was talking about. You can see there's going to be social movements that are going to bring about the kinds of positive changes we want, which, frankly, we would like to see. You know, maybe that fits with the election of Obama, and that possibly there's going to be some similar changes. We can't see how they're going to arise, just as nobody could have in 1960. Imagine, it's hard for people now to see women, pictures of women in pillbox hats and gloves, and think those people actually are the ones where these early social movements are going to come from, and men in ties and suits. Or, you know, we can slap ourselves on the back for things are really better now. But I do think it's really important. This is really a white show, and it's appealing, I think, for its whiteness, whether it's nostalgia or possibilities about the future. I mean, it's not just that the characters, the African-American characters come in terms of how they affect white people.
Mm-hmm.
And the African-American history is how it would appear on the TV for white people. We don't know what will happen in the next few seasons. You know, it's possible, just as we went from the first show was on Madison Avenue and it shocked, I guess, viewers to suddenly move into the home. What were we doing in the home with kitchens and Betty and children? And now that's an integral part of the story is the way they're together. You know, maybe we'll start moving into the black families and their neighborhoods, but really don't know much about them, let alone any other racial group.
And this is one of the questions.
There are some Chinamen, quote unquote, who show up one time as a joke.
And this is one of the things that I've struggled with in trying to understand the dynamics of the show. Is that simply a consequence of what you were just saying in terms of the absence of, in this instance, African Americans? Is that simply a carelessness on the part of the writers, or is that all toward the effect of what they're trying to create with this show? So, it's just a question. I wasn't necessarily demanding you answer it, but that's kind of because the response, I think, becomes different, because I'm not sure if it's simply just omission, but it's, as you said, that they're trying to recreate a certain kind of lifestyle as it appeared to those people who lived it, you know, who were white, who were middle class, who were professionals,
right,
who were in these circles.
Well, and you'd have to ask the demographic that they've got watching the show.
Right.
If you then moved into these other neighborhoods and populations, would they still watch the show? I mean, maybe, because you've actually got so much interest in the show and the historical aspects of it, and they could be making a calculation that we want to go there, or they could be completely unaware of it.
Yeah.
Or,
you know. And I wonder,
I do.
Yeah.
But the show is fundamentally about the crisis of the privileged white male subject, right? I mean, again, it's Don falling off the building. It's, you know, as the first image that we see, right? Mm-hmm. Something like a Twin Tower, right?
He's that's why I couldn't watch it.
Yes,
but is it really? I mean, that's a draw that can draw men in, but in so many ways, this show is really about and for women. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, so if it said that it was about Betty or Peggy, you would have no male viewers. So that label, and beginning with men smoking, and that will bring in male viewers without maybe them originally recognizing that they get to watch all this sex and men, you know, chasing women and doing things they know are now prohibited. Oh, well, I mean, they're still doing it in slightly different ways, but
I still want a bar in my office.
Yeah, we're going to put a wet bar right here in the corner. Absolutely. So going to have always going to be an ice bucket there.
Not allowed at the university.
It's full. I don't know who's going to be in charge of filling the ice bucket. Well, and something that I think about, and I don't know if this is sort of too far off the point, but I think about the fact that the guy who created the show, Matthew Weiner, was a writer on The Sopranos, and he pitched this idea to HBO a long time ago, and it just sat. And in fact, one of the things I read about it was he actually wrote the pilot for the show in 1999. That was 11 years ago. Things now today are not the way that they were 11 years ago. And I guess I wonder if part of the reason maybe people resonate with Don falling off the building is that right now, a lot of people have a sense that they've fallen off a building. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that can darken, you know, this is not a happy, optimistic time. And I wonder if partly that's why people are identifying with the show as well, and how, you know, then you start thinking, well, how might the show have gone differently, or what was the original idea, or what kind of storylines would there be? How is where we are now and where we've been the last couple of years affecting the writing of the show? Because the way shows like this get written is that, you know, they get written an episode at a time, and people sit around and they say, okay, what do we want to do? And what's going to happen to this character? And what are the, you know, even if you have some idea what story arcs are going to be, you really have the opportunity to kind of make it up as you're going along. And I'm sure that, like everybody else, the writers, you know, what they happen to be feeling at a particular point, they're saying, well, let's do this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that gets back to my question about, well, in what ways is the show about now? Mm-hmm.
Which we
think?
Still
haven't answered. Yeah, maybe you give us some answers.
I don't know. See, you guys, that's what you guys do. See, you're here to figure all that stuff
we
out.
We engage. We don't answer.
I thought that was my job. I just ask questions. I don't have to worry about answering.
Our answer is it's complex.
But I think in some ways, I mean, the answer is that these issues are, I mean, the struggles of the 1960s, my comment was not so much that things have necessarily gotten better because, I mean, things have changed, but there's continuity. And so these issues, we talk about gender, we talk about class, race, sexuality, or what have you. I mean, this is still contested ground. If we think about, you know, the law, if we think about policy, if we think about culture or what have you, I mean, we're still fighting around these very issues. I mean, even the legislation that was passed during that period is not legislation that's written in stone now. A lot of these things, if we talk about civil rights coverage and legislation, these things have been challenged at the Supreme Court. There have been some wins, but there also have been some losses. And so there's a toggling back and forth, you know. There's always this drama about, are we going to turn the clock back, or are we going to move forward? And so I think in some ways that's kind of what's getting worked out in the show, would be my guess. That's what makes, I think, this challenging and fun, for me at least, is because the answers that you can come up with are open-ended in some ways.
Let's see if we can get one more caller in here. We're drawing down to just a couple of minutes left. Someone in Effingham on our toll-free line here, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I think the show was about the late 50s into 1960s. When American hegemony and world dominance was taking place. And that had then led us into what now has become mass consumerism ideals. I mean, the masses don't consume. Only the upper classes consume to the degree that it implies. And I think that is what is happening. And I watch that show, and I learn from it the misogynistic ideas and the dominance of males, and the old generation who Mr. Draper was subjected to, you know, when the company sold and all that. So that's my take on it. Thanks, Dave.
All right, sure. Well, that gets at both, I mean, some things we've talked about, both the consumerist angle, which is, of course, very, very obvious and right there, and then this other, the geopolitical thing that's kind of subtext, but it's something that's also there.
Yeah, I think it's true. And I mean, the point about hegemony, the kind of the end of hegemony, which of course we're seeing yet again now, or we're seeing when, you know, again, I think this gets back to when the show was originally conceived, and yet the fact that it resonates now, the fact that it's on now, our new enemy, Cold War style, all of the ways in which we are reliving, in some sense, the problematics of the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah. One thing, just real quick, maybe we had about a minute left. I'm really curious to ask Leslie Regan, because way back when we started to talk, you said when you saw the first one of these shows, and you said you hated it, and you said, I don't need this. This is not what I want to watch. What brought you back to the show, and how is it that you can watch it now?
Well, really, when I saw it, it was this opening shot. I just didn't want to bring up 9/11 of him falling. Okay. Yeah. I really couldn't bear that. And then that was just too graphic for me. It doesn't have the kind of violence of action film at all. And then also the sexism of the first show. I don't even remember the exact remarks. Really, it was a friend telling me, you will find this more interesting. There's a lot more about the women, and if you follow it, I'm not sure it's actually maybe more about the women and how their lives are changing, and you should give it a try. So that convinced me. And then I got caught up in the show.
Yeah.
And it is a really smart, complicated, and interesting show. Because obviously we've talked about it for an hour now.
Yeah. And you all are going to spend a day talking about it at the end of the week. Is this the kind of thing that's opened if people are interested in attending some of this?
Absolutely, yeah.
Is open?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's going to be more than just on the show. It's actually on the culture of the 1960s. So it's you don't have to have already been a fan or know about the show in order to, I think, enjoy the symposium.
Yeah, it's at the Levis Faculty Center. Oh, that's what I was just checking.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah,
there's going to be – there will also be, I'm sure, many clips from the show and videos. So even if you haven't seen it, you'll get to see lots of pieces of it throughout the day.
And can you switch off your analysis here? I mean, can you watch a show like this and just have a good time? Or is it always – yes?
I do.
Personally, you can? Yes.
I do.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You just like spending time with the characters, even when you don't like them.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of the time. So.
Which is a lot of the time. Well, our guest this morning, Clarence Lang, he is an assistant professor of African American Studies and History here at the U of I. Lilia Kaganovsky, she is associate professor of Slavic Languages and Literatures, and also you're in cinema studies?
That's correct.
As well. And Leslie Regan, she is associate professor of History, Medicine, Gender, Women's Studies, and Law at the U of I, and they'll all be taking part in this symposium, Mad World, Sex, Politics, Style, and the 1960s, talking about the series Mad Men. It takes place Friday at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. And if you're looking for Mad Men, the fourth season starts sometime this
August.
Year. Sometime this summer. Otherwise, if people want to catch up, they can go out and look at the DVDs. I think actually you can get them from iTunes if you want to. There are ways that you can see the show, so if you want to see it. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.